300 years ago, Sir Thomas More invented the word utopia, where everything was going to be hunky-dory. But now we know it's going to be a green-powered Earth, and that'll be solartopia. Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, so we had to work pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia.
Yes, we did. We started to burn many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back for another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness show. Got tons and tons to deal with today. Hoping for David Swanson, our guest, one of the great activists of our time, and we'll be joined by him. Is David here?
Hear me, Harvey.
Yes, David, I can hear you loud and clear. How are you?
Hi. Didn't mean to give anyone the impression I wasn't here.
Well, you are here. We all know you're here. This is David Swanson, ladies and gentlemen. David is about as persistent and dogged and indefatigable and articulate an activist I've ever met. He is focused on issues of war and peace primarily, the Constitution, the environment, and so many other things that we love to talk about. And so, David, I want to start first with the really, really important stuff. I'm sure you watched the Super Bowl yesterday. I loved the 34-minute blackout. Can you imagine? What a message. And by the way, the power company that is responsible for the electricity going into the Superdome, Entergy, is a big nuclear power player. In fact, I think they own I'm not sure how many they own, but I think they, well, I'll look it up actually since I have access to the internet here, but they do own Vermont Yankee and the Fitzpatrick or Fitzgerald reactors in New York and Vermont, which we are hoping to shut. So, David, I hope you won a lot of money on the Super Bowl. What do you think?
Well, I didn't bid anything, and I'm not sure I would collect, given the fact that they've apparently determined it's inappropriate to call penalties on important plays near the end of the game. not that such things would necessarily decide the winner, but they might.
Does that mean you're a 49ers fan?
Well, you know, I'm a lot closer to Baltimore geographically. I'd say if I had to root for a team, I'd root for Baltimore. But I also don't like the rooting for a team stuff too much because it's what trains us to root for countries as if they're teams. The Super Bowl is largely a military hype machine full of commercials promoting the goodness and glory of killing people. And so I have a number of problems with the Super Bowl. But the lights going out, I think, is an indication. You know, it can at least be taken as a metaphor for the direction our nation is moving in terms of crumbling infrastructure. I mean, what Panetta, our outgoing Secretary of War, said: if we don't keep dumping more and more money into wars, we're going to become a second tier nation. You know, well, wouldn't that be wonderful if we were in second place in anything? I mean, we're in, you know, 22nd place in unemployment, 26th place in schools, 35th place in poverty, 37th place in health care, 48th place in infant mortality. I mean, to be second in anything would be great. You know, it may be that the Olympics start looking at the United States as a dubious host for major events.
Well, that's an interesting idea. You know, we do have some human rights violations going on here. There's no doubt about that. We have Bradley Manning, who's been in prison for God knows how long without being tried or even charged with anything for quite a while. We have Leonard Peltier, who's been in prison way longer than was Nelson Mandela, who's never had a fair trial. Lots of stuff for Amnesty International to talk about for this country, so I'm sure there are plenty of boycotts that could be done on human rights violations. I did want to say that, you know, when it comes to the Super Bowl now, in my advancing age, I start to root just for a good game. And it was a decent game, I have to say, within the framework of actual football. But the
indeed.
But the blackout was quite amazing, actually. Of course, part of it, you know, is the charm and the mystery and the magic of New Orleans, and kind of a reminder of Katrina. And of course, the place where they played the Super Bowl this time was essentially a refugee camp in the middle of Katrina. Isn't that correct?
Well, it was, yes. It was a place where people came, and there was no power then. It was a place where people came and, in many cases, died. It was a sort of a concentration camp. Minimal effort was made to assist people in evacuating, much less create the proper precautions for such disasters, the proper people having indeed been warned and having known it was coming. The image of that building, and then to see it plastered with Mercedes-Benz logos and all of these advertisements for things that the vast majority of Americans will never be able to afford, no matter how many Republicans they vote for, it's this clash. It's this unequal society that we're developing. I mean, where you walk through the ruins of Hurricane Sandy in New York City, and you pass dealerships for Ferraris and Maseratis there on Wall Street, and there's something just revolting to me about the way a few hundred and in some degree a few thousand Americans are able to live while so many are reduced to things that not too many years ago we would have thought were outrageous.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I did have one fantasy with, you know, the Mercedes-Benz logo, which I was shocked to see on the roof of the Superdome there. Maybe you and I should get like one of those cherry picker things and go up there and turn it into a peace symbol. Just add the tail to the semaphore there, and the Mercedes-Benz arena could become the peace arena. That would be nice, wouldn't it?
That would be excellent. Yeah, I think that peace logo was created from the two semaphore signals for NND, I think, for
yes,
nuclear
that's
disarmament.
Correct. Nuclear and disarmament. That's right. And it certainly stuck, that symbol. And, I guess, I don't know if it came before or after the Mercedes-Benz logo. I assume it came afterwards. But it's a short hop, a single line from a Mercedes-Benz logo to a peace symbol to a nuclear disarmament symbol. So maybe someday the Superdome will make that leap. I'm hoping it'll be soon. We're talking with David Swanson here. David Swanson, one of the great peace activists of our time. David, tell us a bit about yourself and what you're really focused on right now. We got a full hour here, and I want to get to know you real well, along with my listeners.
Well, as you know, Harvey, I live in Charlottesville, Virginia, which is a fairly progressive city, a university town in a fairly backward right-wing political area of the country.
Right. Well, it's the home of Thomas Jefferson and Dave Matthews, right?
As well as James Monroe and the University of Virginia and Edgar Allan Poe and James Madison's house up the road. And it's a place that was built by slaves that came out of slavery, that up until the 1950s saw white people refusing to go to school if black kids were going to be allowed to go to school, and that has made a good deal of progress to the point where when a city council member recently suggested that maybe we should have public statues other than Civil War generals that were put up in ceremonies that included the Ku Klux Klan for the cause of racism, she actually was not lynched, was merely slandered and libeled and called every nasty name in the book. So we have, you know, some progress yet to go. We are, of course, also down the road from Lake Anna's nuclear reactors.
Yes, and they, of course, were recently hit by earthquakes, and yes. And their design specifications were exceeded by these earthquakes. Not a real reassuring prospect. So, David, I'm living in Charlottesville, and I have been there. It's a lovely place, actually. Seems very civilized. I also went to Monticello, which, and it is Monticello, by the way. They made that clear when I was there. It is a place built by slaves, but it certainly has some amazing things to look at. That's always a dichotomy with guys like Thomas Jefferson. You know, Jefferson in particular, such a contradiction in so many terms. On the one hand, a slave owner, a terrible opponent of the Haitian Revolution when the slaves in Haiti rose up. He really was extremely hostile to them, and yet the priest, his original draft of the Declaration of Independence allegedly called for, criticized the King of England for supporting slavery. What do you make of old Tom Jefferson and all his contradictions? As a homie there, as a hometown boy in Charlottesville,
I think he had some very good inclinations that were largely limited to wealthy white males. I think that he on one level was able to see the wrong of slavery, was able to see the wrong of the treatment of Native Americans, and yet engaged in both and excused both in his own mind through racism and bigotry. I think that he has an outstanding record of proposing ideas and enacting ideas for a constitutional government that would limit and check powers of those in office. And on the other hand, he was instrumental in giving us the disastrous two-party system. He was instrumental in expanding the U.S. empire, in slaughtering Native Americans, in expanding the Navy to foreign escapades, introducing control of Middle Eastern territories to the United States, introducing suicide bombing to the Middle East as the Americans sailed a ship into port and blew themselves up. This is someone who was a slave owner, a rapist, a bigot, a hypocrite. And yet, if you want to look at the very good ideas that came out of him, they are among the best and were far ahead of their time. To such an extent that we hang on to the Constitution now as if it were some sort of sacred thing, despite the fact that it is now far behind the times.
Yes, and of course, one of the great contradictions about Tom Jefferson, my favorite actually, is that for all his progressive beliefs, he did manage to, when he was 47, impregnate his 17-year-old house slave, Sally Hemings, while they were in Paris with the first of their, apparently seven children. There's some debate. I've read that he and Sally had seven, and two of them died. Two of them passed for white. One of them moved to Ohio, actually, the firstborn, imaginatively named Thomas, born in Paris to Tom and Sally Hemings, Tom Jefferson and Sally Hemings. And then when they came back to Monticello, young Tom Jr. there looked so much like his father that they had to move him to another plantation and became known as Thomas Woodson, and then moved to Ohio, to Circleville, Ohio, actually, where the census lists him as a son of Thomas Jefferson. The friends of Thomas Jefferson used to not talk about Sally Hemings, but to deny that there was any connection, and even to claim that it was his brother that impregnated her, which was ridiculous. But when I went to Monticello, I guess it was 2 years ago, they were kind of sheepishly acknowledging Sally and saying, well, yeah, they had this relationship and these children and what the heck.
Yeah, they changed official policy. I mean, they are a bureaucracy and they follow instructions, and the tour guides are, they're generally pretty good as far as tour guides at ancient sites go. Some of them are friendlier and more informed than others, but they changed policy. It used to be if you asked about such matters, they would avoid the question and deny it and claim there was no proof. Now they similarly claim there is no proof, no certainty, but they admit that the general consensus is, and all probability is, that Thomas Jefferson fathered those children.
Yeah, well, the story, which I've actually read in a book, I guess that makes it true, is that for all these years since Tom Jefferson died, the white children of Thomas Jefferson, the white descendants, rather, he had two daughters and a son. The son died very young. The second daughter died somewhat young. The first daughter, whose name I believe was Martha, had 10 children. And so, and she ran Monticello while Tom was in his dotage there. And that group of 10 white descendants of Tom Jefferson formed, and all their progeny formed a kind of a union or a social club. And then they spent 200 years denying that the Negro, the colored, the African-American descendants of Tom and Sally were actually his. And then in a story that could only happen in America, the two groups in the 1990s, maybe, or early 2000s, got together, and there was DNA testing, and the DNA testing seemed to pretty clearly indicate that these African Americans were descendants of Thomas Jefferson. And there was a big hug, a group hug on, guess where, Oprah, and then I guess the issue was done. It was a done deal. Did you follow any of that in Charlottesville, David?
Certainly there's been, local interest in the family reunions and when the white folks would allow the black folks to participate. I missed the Oprah, I'm afraid. But, this is when Virginia admits things, when it can do no other. This is when we let people out of prison who've been railroaded by prosecutors with an axe to grind, when DNA proves it. And if you don't have any DNA evidence, well, too bad for you. In defense, however, of the state of Virginia, there has recently been a positive decision not to begin mining uranium here, and Virginia may be about to take the lead in banning drones from its skies.
All right, well, let's get down to it here. Let's get down to the real stuff. We've had our fun with Tom Jefferson, we've ascertained that, yes, he did have descendants with his slave Sally Hemings. The question is, were they in love? We'll leave that for another show. So, David, let's talk about you being one of the preeminent peace activists in the United States. You've got your hometown now, Charlottesville, on the brink of doing something important for peace. Why don't you give us the details, please?
Well, it's not good politics or reporting to count our chickens before they're hatched, but this evening Charlottesville City Council will at the very least be considering a draft resolution that would prohibit the city from buying or using or testing drones, would direct the city to draft an ordinance to prevent drones from entering Charlottesville skies, would send a message to the Virginia State Assembly to direct them to keep drones, surveillance drones and weaponized drones, out of the state of Virginia, as well as directing the federal government to end its extrajudicial killing program for which it uses drones. Meanwhile, the relevant committee of the House of Delegates in Richmond has just passed yesterday a two-year moratorium that would keep drones out of the skies of Virginia for 2 years while people observe the disasters and violations of rights in other states before deciding how to proceed.
Well, first of all, we're at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, if you want to call in about this. Many of you listen to this after the broadcast, going to our archives. So we are talking with David Swanson on February 4th, 2013, about a resolution being debated tonight in the Charlottesville City Council and ongoing in the Virginia legislature. David, can you give us your website so that people listening in later on, after February 4th, can track down the results of all this?
Yeah, absolutely. You can Google Charlottesville City Council and find their reports and videos of the meeting, but you can also go to my websites, davidswanson.org or warisacrime.org.
Okay, davidswanson.org or warisacrime.org. So, David, you first burst into my consciousness, David Swanson, with the war in Iraq and the horrific lies that were told to the world about, you know, the alleged acquisition of nuclear weapons by Saddam Hussein. I won't say rest in peace for Saddam Hussein, but the departed, the not dear departed Saddam Hussein. And you had a website called After Downing Street. Can you tell us about what Downing Street was and what its implications were and how it might impact our current views of war and peace in the United States?
Well, if you type in afterdowningstreet.org, you will get to the same place as warisacrime.org, to which I changed the name precisely because I had gotten this question so many times. But for you, Harvey, I will answer it one more time, and that is to say, of course, Downing Street is where the Prime Minister lives in the United Kingdom, and there was a meeting there many months before the invasion of Iraq in 2003, a meeting at which the head of intelligence, as they call it, for the United Kingdom was just back from Washington, having met for 90 minutes with the head of the CIA, George Tenet, and was informing the Prime Minister and the rest of the British cabinet of America's position, which he made clear was to start a war on Iraq, regardless of whether the United Nations went along, regardless of whether there were weapons in Iraq, and in fact to distort the information to move the public in such manner to get the war started, and this was official minutes of that meeting that were leaked better part of 2 years after the shock and awe invasion of Iraq, and you know, in the weeks and months that followed up until today, you know, additional minutes and documents and memos and proof have been, you know, piling up redundantly upon redundancy to demonstrate what, you know, everybody now accepts, unless they willfully avoid it, that this was a war launched on a package of lies. But there was that moment in 2005 when there was this very authoritative piece of information leaked. People hadn't quite admitted the facts yet, and you had the Democrats in Washington completely out of power and therefore pretending that they gave a damn about peace and justice. And so you had the Democratic Party suggesting that if we put them in power, they would end the wars and impeach the president. And, of course, we put them in power, and they did no such thing. They expanded the wars. They said they needed the White House, so we gave them the White House. They continued more or less the same policies and said they needed a filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. Well, we gave them opportunity after opportunity to undo the filibuster rule in the Senate, and they chose not to. So if I sound a little a little less cheerful than I may have at that moment in 05 when they were pretending they gave a damn, that's why.
Well, okay, so we then, of course, sank deep into the abyss of the horror show in Iraq. And just for the record, Davis, David Swanson, tell us, what did the United States actually accomplish in Iraq?
Well, the greatest displacement of human beings, according to international observers, since the Nakba, since the creation of Israel, displaced Palestinians. Millions of refugees, millions of them outside Iraq, in neighboring nations, and in nations around the globe, millions within Iraq, a segregated society, neighborhoods and cities divided by sectarian beliefs, over a million dead bodies in excess of the incredible death rate that was in place under the sanctions that preceded this latest invasion, extensive environmental damage, much of which will never be undone, cultural damage that devastated the heritage of the nation of Iraq. I mean, the destruction in so many aspects and on such level that people began using the term sociocide to indicate indicate the destruction of a society, at the expense, of course, of thousands of American lives, and the better part of our Bill of Rights, as the establishment of a permanent emergency state, has moved us through the Bush administration and aggravated further during the Obama administration to the elimination of habeas corpus, the power of presidents to spy without warrant, imprison without charge, and murder without trial. I mean, this has been absolutely devastating, and it's been labeled a war on terror, while of course it has dramatically expanded terrorism globally and within Iraq. Human rights in Iraq are in a worse place now than when the hated Saddam Hussein, hated by you and me and the people of Iraq, but not by the U.S. government, was in power, with the support at the time, of course, of the government in Washington, D.C.
Well, that's a mouthful. And how much money did all this cost us?
Well, hundreds of billions of dollars in direct expenditure, but quite easily trillions of dollars. I mean, at a very conservative estimate put forth by Joseph Stiglitz and Linda Bilmes long before the war got to the sort of ending point it's at now, was $5 trillion. It's almost certainly more when you consider the ongoing cost of caring for veterans, the ongoing cost of paying back debts, the ongoing impact of lost opportunities and higher fuel prices and so forth. I mean, there are those who made a bundle. There are those who, in particular, certain oil corporations that pushed for the war to begin with, that made out terrifically and are continuing to do so. The weapons makers and the other contractors and mercenary companies of the U.S. military and the U.S. military itself, of course, made out very, very well. We've doubled the size of the U.S. military during the Bush and Obama years thus far. I mean, so there are those who did well, but overall, you know, the financial cost, the economic cost on top of every other one, has been tremendous and has contributed to a recession here in the United States that, combined with the tax cuts and the direct cost of the war, has put our government in a horrible place that it's now manipulating to go after our Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid.
Absolutely. Now, of course, the war in Afghanistan followed directly. There was an overlap with the war in Iraq, so let's go through that. Then we'll Matt, if we can take a break now. We're talking with David Swanson about peace and war and its cost. What I want to do after the break, David, is talk how we segued from Iraq into Afghanistan, and then what we can possibly do now. What are the prospects for peace, and what will they bring us? We're with David Swanson here at the Soarotopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We'll be back in just a moment.
Lines make a damn. New plants, oil refineries, pipelines make a damn. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam.
Well, there we go. We're back. The Great Dane Alliance of Cows with Guns fame, singing the Rocky Top version of Soarotopia. We're here with David Swanson, a fantastic long-term peace activist, writer, blogger, and organizer. You gave us, David, a really grim but accurate view of the costs and the realities of what came out of the war in Iraq. There was, of course, an overlap from the war in Iraq into the war in Afghanistan, complete with the extermination of Osama bin Laden. Can you tell us now your view of, well, first talk about bin Laden and what you think it really meant that he was killed and the way he was killed by Barack Obama.
Well, I don't know any more accurate term than murder. If I kill someone intentionally, it's murder. If the president does it, it's murder. When the president goes through a list of men, women, and children every other Tuesday and picks which ones to have killed, including many individuals who could easily have been detained rather than killed, including men, women, children, Americans, non-Americans, and has them killed, it's murder. It's murder by president. It's not assassination, which is a species of murder that refers to the murdering of famous high elected officials. And it's not sort of incidental killing or collateral damage. It's not the killing that results from cutting off people's social security or allowing unsafe working conditions. It's murder. It's intentionally, directly, violently ending lives. The collateral damage, as they call it, is, of course, more extensive than the targeted, that the people dying from these attacks with drones, I'm not counting night raids and other forms of attack, the majority are people who were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. The people targeted are, for the most part, are in many cases not even known by name. In some cases, it's merely targeting of individuals rescuing the injured and the bodies from a previous strike. It's called a double tap. The victims are referred to as bug splat. So exterminating is maybe an accurate term for how it's thought about within the military and the CIA and the White House. But these are human beings we're talking about, and none of them are charged with a crime. None of them are put on trial. They are simply killed. And if anyone leaks any information about such a program, they are deemed an enemy and threatened with life in prison or worse. But when the president leaks information, when the White House leaks information, when John Brennan blatantly lies about what happened in order to hype the glory of having murdered a well-known, famous enemy of the United States, well, then that's all appropriate and right. And I think it's actually rather revolting. As more and more details came out, it became very clear that the instructions to the Navy were to kill, not to capture, to avoid capturing and to kill this individual, which makes America look weak, not strong, and which does nothing but harm to the rule of law in our country and others. Are we afraid to put someone on trial for crimes in our own country, someone charged with and at length convicted of in the media of the worst crimes that anyone knows of in recent years? I think it's a horrible, horrible trend, and these night raids are happening every night. This is the one that people are told about, but it's every night. And to suggest that all of the victims do not deserve a trial is a very, very dangerous path to go down.
There you go. We're with David Swanson, warisnotacrime.org, numerous publications. I don't know, have you seen this movie, Zero Dark 40?
I think it's Zero Dark 30.
30,
and
yeah, Dark 30, whatever.
I really don't want to contribute to it. I don't want to watch it, but I have unavoidably seen so many bits and pieces and so many interviews of the women who made it and critiques and reviews by people who have subjected themselves to it, defenses of it by no less than Michael Moore and rejections of that defense by much wiser heads, that I feel well enough informed to say that a movie that that has intelligent, well-informed people suggesting that maybe viewers will understand that the torture wasn't helpful, and everyone else saying, look how helpful the torture was, suggests to me that the movie is a bit of a Rorschach test. And when the people who managed to denounce the torture while praising President Obama, no enemy of torture, he glorify the murder of Osama bin Laden, I have a real problem. And I know for a fact that very smart, well-intended people muted their criticism because the movie was made by a woman. My God, if that is the path we're going down, while a pro-war woman has just left the State Department with every intention of becoming effectively the emperor of the world 4 years hence, we're in bad straits.
We're talking with David Swanson. David, let's segue from there into the... I have not seen the movie Zero Dark Thirty. I'm not sure I want to. I did watch... what's the previous one she made?
Hurt Locker.
Hurt Locker, which I found devastating. Just the portrait of the war in Iraq was just so ghastly. I didn't know what to think of it quite ideologically. I didn't want to judge it on that level, but I thought it was anyone who watched that movie who would then think about the war in Iraq would just be utterly appalled. Now, let's talk about the war in Afghanistan. We segued, of course, from Iraq into Afghanistan. It's now become, except for the war on drugs, the longest war in U.S. history. Obama is making rumblings of kind of sort of maybe, if you think about it, winding down. I don't know. What is your impression of what's happening with the war in Afghanistan, and what do you think Obama is going to do?
Well, it was not the war that George W. Bush wanted. He was willing to go there as long as Iraq would come next, and that's what he told Tony Blair. And it was a war that was sort of maintained at a low level as a permanent emergency, as an endless war, while attention was diverted to Iraq. And it came to resemble these wars in Africa and Latin America and Asia that have dragged on for decades, with both sides prioritizing the exploitation of civilians over actually trying to defeat each other. Wars bring profits. Afghanistan is, you know, one of the very poorest nations on earth. The war money, the payments to the Taliban for safe passage down roads that are effectively funding the other side in the war, the aid money that has become very much a part of the military occupation and has enriched so many people in Afghanistan. All of these things create motivations not to end the war, but to keep it going indefinitely, and it sort of became a permanent war. President Obama, as a candidate the first time, said he would escalate it, said he would make it a focus, would make it a bigger war, and he did so. He more than tripled the number of troops in Afghanistan, although the media often downplay that. And we're now just about back. We're getting close to back to where U.S. troop levels were when Obama became president. And he's talking about ending the war by the end of next year, by the end of 2014, by which he doesn't mean ending it, but scaling it down and calling it ending it. And it's remarkable to me in that most U.S. wars and most wars in the history of the world have taken less than 2 years from beginning to end. And here we are constantly giving this president credit for quote-unquote ending a war over the next 2 years. I mean, this is a disaster that has come out of the lies and the misunderstandings, not that got Iraq going, but that kept Iraq going and ended it with a so-called surge, which Obama came to defend and redeploy the same rhetoric to Afghanistan.
Okay, so let's say that he is going to wind us down. I don't know what the projected residual troop levels would be. I mean, how many people do we still have in Iraq?
In Iraq, the U.S. military on a permanent basis is supposedly gone. There are, of course, special forces and CIA, and the State Department has got thousands of mercenaries and thousands of employees. But Iraq is largely over, which, of course, has left a disaster in Iraq, but not the heightened disaster that Fox News told us would happen year after year after year if we were ever to withdraw. In fact, as troops were withdrawn from various areas of Iraq, the violence predictably went down.
Right, right. I call that the 1979 Mardi Gras factor. In 1979, the police in New Orleans went on strike for Mardi Gras, and everybody predicted horrific violence, and the crowds were way, way down. And I actually went to that Mardi Gras. It was fantastic. And there was zero crime. No cops, no crime. And so, of course, that's hopefully the inevitable bloodbath that they talked about in Vietnam, which turned out to happen in Cambodia, which we were responsible for, of course. And now Iraq didn't happen. But in Afghanistan, I suppose we're to envision a country with some U.S. permanent presence, you know, commercial and otherwise, but the troops will be gone, so allegedly. So what happens now to the defense budget and to the American military presence around the world?
Well, I don't think we have a defense budget because I don't see anything.
I'm sorry, the military budget.
Yeah, the war preparations budget and the war budget, you know, put together are over $600 billion. And when you add in the so-called Homeland Security Department and the nukes in the Energy Department and the mercenaries in the State Department and the provision of weapons to foreign nations and all the rest of it, and when you consider the cost of caring for veterans and paying the interest on the debt for previous wars and war preparation, you know, you're over half federal discretionary spending. You're well over $1 trillion, $1.2 to $1.3 trillion every year for wars, which is as much as the rest of the world put together. You add in the NATO countries and you're at three-quarters of military spending globally. You know, there's not a credible enemy in sight. There are enemies being manufactured. I mean, the United States is building bases around China, provoking China, and using the fact that China is enlarging its military expenditures as an excuse to do the same here, even though the United States is spending several times what China is and blatantly provoking an arms race. Now, getting out of Afghanistan would certainly save tens of billions of dollars a year. I would love to see some fraction of that money put to good use, given to Afghan civilian, non-governmental, pro-democracy groups. I'm not counting on it, but at the very least, to end the counterproductive so-called counterinsurgency efforts in Afghanistan financially would save us tens of billions of dollars. I may have missed it in the Super Bowl. Correct me if I'm wrong. I usually they thank U.S. troops watching in so and so many nations around the world. Usually it's about 177. I didn't see that last night, but that's about $170 billion a year, apart from Afghanistan, to keep U.S. bases and golf courses and restaurants and movie theaters in the majority of nations around the globe. That could be ended with the support of the right and the left in this country, and we could save a bundle of money.
Yes, indeed. We're talking with David Swanson, War is a Crime. .org, after downingstreet.org. David, your most recent book, what's it about? What's it called?
Well, I wrote a children's book called Tube World.
What's it called?
Called Tube World. You can find all my books at davidswanson.org. I guess the most recent political book I wrote was called When the World Outlawed War, which is about the Peace Pact of 1928, which is still on the books.
The Kellogg-Briand Treaty.
Indeed, yes.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, you know, during the 20s and the 30s, war was very unpopular in the United States and elsewhere. I mean, extremely unpopular and viewed as a European backward affair that our forward-looking nation ought to set behind us, and we ought not to be dragged into another world war like what later became known as World War I. You had farmers with more influence in Washington than the weapons makers desiring that the Europeans buy more grain and fewer weapons. You had the women's groups now with the right to vote turning their focus to ending war. you had a movement that I focus on, led by a lawyer out of Chicago, that sought to outlaw war, to make it a crime, because the making of war had never been a crime. It was only particular atrocities that had ever been treated as crimes. And this happened, and it happened with tremendous public support, all of the big wealthy nations of the world signing on, wars ending, wars being prevented, and when World War II happened, the war makers being prosecuted for the first time ever on the basis of the Kellogg-Briand Pact for the crime of making war. And then the common thinking goes, well, we got the United Nations, the Kellogg-Briand Pact became outdated, and by the way, it didn't work because World War II happened. You know, as if when you ban drunk driving and the first guy drives drunk and you put him in prison, you declare it didn't work, everybody hit the road, have a drink. You know, this is not the way you treat laws. The first time you enforce them, you start looking for the second time to enforce them and how to make them stronger. And it's a treaty that is still on the books and ought to be enforced.
Well, tell us about how, you know, the bad rap on the Kellogg-Briand Treaty and, you know, that time when people renounced war is that it did lead to World War II. So tell us the fallacies behind that argument.
Well, renouncing war didn't lead to World War II. Nobody was imagining that war was over or that declaring it illegal would magically make it be over. The goal of the movement that declared it illegal also sought to create an effective world court that would arbitrate disagreements and prosecute the crime of making war. And we've never quite gotten there. This was to be the beginning of an educational process in cultural change along the lines of having outgrown blood feuds and having outgrown dueling. And without, you know, banning aggressive dueling and maintaining defensive dueling, but rather declaring the whole practice barbaric, declaring it illegal, and outgrowing it through a number of steps over a period of time. This was what was to happen with war. And so the Kellogg-Briand Pact declared war illegal across the board, whether aggressive or defensive, humanitarian or philanthropic or fascistic, war would be illegal and not be used going forward. And so because at the same time the nations were arming, because at the same time the politics in Germany and in Japan and elsewhere were moving in a horrible direction with great assistance from U.S. corporations and the U.S. government, by the way. We were doing many things wrong as well as doing a couple things right during that period. Because a war then happened and the U.N. Charter was created, people sort of set the Kellogg-Briand Pact away as part of history. But the U.N. Charter allows wars if you call them defensive, and allows wars if the UN Security Council approves them, which are two giant loopholes that you can drive many a war through. And so the Kellogg-Briand Pact is actually a stronger treaty to which we ought to be aspiring.
Very interesting. So let's envision a world 2 years from now. Let's say Obama keeps his word. We phase out of Afghanistan. We don't get into another war, which would be astounding. You know, this moment arises when, whoop, suddenly we're not at war. What happens? Is this going to happen? What will the impact be on our country?
Well, I mean, if the United States were to get out of Afghanistan militarily, it would have to also get its drones and missiles and satellites out of Afghanistan through a convincing commitment. And then there would be some 150, 170 other nations to consider. The U.S. has so-called special forces actively engaged in dozens of nations. The United States is engaging in what have come to be called drone wars, in several nations at the moment, despite the lack, of course, of any declaration of war. We haven't had one since 1941. And so were we to end all of that, were we to end the drone wars that are now under investigation as crimes by the United Nations, the drone wars that are taking us into new countries and creating the conditions to send in ground troops rather than scaling back wars as people fantasize the drones are doing, if we were to end all of that, and we were to end the financial expense of it, we would see our popularity soar in places like Pakistan and Yemen, where our government is hated by the vast majority of people because of what it does with these drones and missiles. And we would see the ability, whether or not we get a civilized healthcare system, which is another possible solution, whether or not we tax corporations and billionaires, which is another possible solution, we would see, merely by cutting military spending, the ability to have education and green energy and infrastructure and a lifestyle that we don't dare dream of today.
Well, of course, some of us do dream of it. I have a book called Solartopia. That was a good dream.
Yes,
actually, you
did.
Read it. You liked it. So.
Oh, I love it. That's. I don't think we would be there, but we would be on the way there. We would be taking a step towards Solartopia.
So what should we do, listeners to this show? By the way, we're at 888-874-4888 with David Swanson, the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show, talking about peace and war. What do we do to bring about this magic moment here? 2 years from now, or 2015, let's say, Obama has another year or so to go. Hillary is gearing up to become the next president or whatever. What do we do? What do we do to make all this happen and to seize upon the moment?
Resign your membership or any connection or affiliation with either of the two major political parties. Declare yourself an independent activist. Organize and educate and get active in every way that you can. Call your two senators and any other senators you can, especially on the relevant committee, between now and Thursday, and tell them that John Brennan, a supporter of torture, rejected for it 4 years ago, should not now be an acceptable member of the U.S. cabinet because he's run an assassination program with drones. Contact the House and the Senate and tell them that they will have your complete and utter creative nonviolent opposition and resistance if they don't take the money out of the military rather than our Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid over the coming weeks. Get a movement going as the weather warms up this spring, and the best programs of our government are under assault and the worst are undergoing expansion. Get active in the streets, in the parks, give birth to a new Occupy movement. February 15th marks 10 years since we took over the streets of the world to say no to war, and we imagined it had no impact, but it made that war illegal. It exposed the wrongdoing, and it built an activist movement that has done great things. Take this opportunity to restart that, and you know, don't give in to overly wise defeatism. Understand that when anything has gone right, it's because people stopped saying it's impossible and did it.
Right on, David Swanson, an inveterate activist, and you know, God, 10 years since those mass marches on Iraq, that is truly amazing. Anyone who ever doubts the power of organized peace movements, I don't recommend by any way, shape, or form reading the whole book, but in Richard Nixon's autobiography, he concedes that had it not been for the movement against the war in Vietnam, for the peace movement, for the peace, those of us in the streets marching, he would have used nuclear weapons in Vietnam. Can you imagine our world today had Richard Nixon used nuclear weapons in Vietnam? It would be...
God, and imagine Harvey, the expanded peace movement, if that confession had been public at the time. You know, George W. Bush makes the same sort of confession in his memoirs. Imagine if people knew it and knew it at the time, how our numbers would have multiplied. And yet it's always true. We always have influence, and they always pretend we don't.
Exactly. And I believe today is the 100th anniversary of the birth of Rosa Parks. It's also the 26th anniversary of the birth of my twin daughters, Annie and Abby, February 4th here. So, David Swanson, it's been wonderful being with you and having you, our voice of tremendous clarity and optimism. We are going to continue. Of course, we didn't even get to renewable energy, so we're going to have to do that the next time I have you in. Part and parcel of ridding the world of war is ridding it of fossil fuels and nuclear power, which themselves, of their essence, are war on the environment, on our, on human and all other health, on our ability to survive on this planet. And, as we transition to a war, to a world without war, a world based on peace, we are also going to be transitioning to a world based on renewable energy. David, give us your websites again as we start to segue out of here.
Well, I agree with all of that. I'm at davidswanson.org. I'm at warisacrime.org, and I also work for rootsaction.org. And maybe I'll see you in D.C. on the 17th, Harvey.
Well, I don't know about that, but we're going to continue to fight for all these things. I'm looking forward to the day when windmills power Monticello and the whole city of wind and solar power, the whole city of Charlottesville and the rest of the state of Virginia, the rest of the country. Those nuclear plants nearby, they need to be shut, and if anyone can do it, David, it will be you. So next week we're going to have Norman Solomon with us, former congressional candidate in Marin County, my co-author on a book called Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation, published way back in 1982 and still relevant to all this. David, a last word from you, please.
And Norman is, of course, my colleague at rootsaction.org, so check that out in the coming week as well.
All right, we'll see you there. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening in. Matt and the crew at PRN for producing another Solartopia Green Power and Wellness show. We'll see you next week on the radio with Norman Solomon. Keep the faith, and let's have a peaceful world without war.
And the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But don't you know?